Coming up, we got Andrew Sharp talking about point guard musical chairs, Trae Young, LaMelo Ball, Ja Morant, Darius Garland. Who's going where? What's happening next? We're also drafting the NBA's most underrated players. And then later, another edition of Draft Class with my guest, Mo Farah. That's all coming up right now. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. Joining me today to talk about the NBA, Andrew Sharp. Andrew, how are you, man?
I am doing well. We are live. Very exciting stuff. It's great to see you. How are you doing?
I'm doing excellent, Andrew. We got a very much to discuss today with Ja Morant in the news over the weekend. According to Shams Charania, the Grizzlies are entertaining offers for Morant, and their goal is to acquire youth and draft picks for Ja. And so the Memphis Grizzlies right now, Andrew, they're 10th in the Western Conference standings, but they're also tied for 10th in the lottery standings, 4.5 games removed from the fifth best lottery odds. And Sham says that they're considering multiple paths, building around the youth and Jaren Jackson Jr., or even continuing with Morant if there's no great offers out there. What do you think the Grizzlies' preferred path should be?
Well, I would certainly want to trade Ja if I could, if I'm the Memphis Grizzlies right now. The question I have is, for whom does Ja Morant make sense? When you look at the contenders, it's hard to make the argument that he would be a good bet for most of the good teams in the league. And if I'm rebuilding at this point, I don't know. I mean, what are you betting on if you're trading for Ja Morant in 2026 here? Are you betting on, essentially, like, you look at the way his game has fallen off, you're betting on the athleticism coming back and drives to the rim coming back, because you've outlined how that has declined over the last couple of years. It was pretty eye-opening, some of the stats you pulled on Ja. And then also, like, the health, you're betting on more health than he's had all decade if you're trading for Ja. And the maturity, like, literally nothing Ja has said for the last 3 years, said publicly, has signaled any emotional growth as far as his understanding of his responsibilities as a franchise player. And so, I don't know. I mean, a week ago, if we were on here potting, I would have said, I don't know who Trae Young makes sense for when you look out at the other 29 teams in the league. All it takes is one team. Maybe one team will be willing to talk themselves into Ja Morant. But my question for the next couple of weeks is, like, all right, so I get why Memphis would want to move on from Ja, but who is going to be willing to actually do that deal on the other side? What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're hitting on kind of my overarching thought with him right now. So the question on my mind with Ja is, what is Ja Morant worth? What is Ja Morant worth? That's the question on my mind, because what a decline. He wins Rookie of the Year in 2020, becomes the most electric player in the NBA. In the 2022, he makes him the All-Star team, All-NBA, named Most Improved. He's named an All-Star again in 2023. At the time, he had played 80% of all possible games his first 4 years. And then after that, it all fell apart. The guns, the suspensions, the injuries, the lack of leadership. He had played in only 38% of all possible games the last 3 years, and he's expensive. He makes $42 million annually for two more seasons with declining performance, as you said, declining at-rim finishing, not dunking as often. He's plateaued as a subpar shooter, even gotten worse
Horrible from earlier in his career.
Horrible, exactly. And so he's only 26, but right now, at this stage of his career, he looks like a guy who's past the peak of his career. And so I want to be fair to Ja, though, because I've always been critical of him. And this season, midway through first 12 games, he was getting to the rim at a career low rate. Only 18% of his shots were coming in the restricted area. And that's continued a worrisome trend for him year after year, settling for jumpers. Only 31% of his shots came from three. Mm. He was shooting with Killian Hayes level efficiency, though. And then a calf strain knocked him out for a month. He's played only six games since then, still dealing with a calf injury, but the numbers are way up. 36% of his shots are being taken at the rim, only 17% of his shots from three. He's shooting better from every area on the floor. But the funny thing is here, even though it's a super tiny sample, Andrew, that six-game sample is basically equal to his two All-Star seasons that he's had. Mm-hmm. Only decimal points are separating what he did here. His scoring efficiency is pretty much equal. His shot distribution is aligned. Roughly one third of his shots taken at the rim, only half from mid-range, the rest from three-point range. Much better distribution that aligns with what he did as an all-star in 2021 and 2022 and 2023. And so I ask you, Andrew, could trading for Ja actually be a buy-low opportunity?
Well, I think that's what a lot of people, that's certainly what Memphis would be selling as they're trying to make the case that, yeah, Ja could help your team. And I add that to the list of things that a potential Ja Morant trade partner is betting on. You're betting on those last six games that he played. That's the real Ja Morant, and that's where this is going. It's not the craziest risk in the world if you have literally nothing else going on. So, like, the team that's been mentioned in the Ja rumors over the last 2 weeks that has made me raise an eyebrow is maybe Milwaukee rolls the dice on Ja Morant and talks themselves into it because they don't really have a path to any other star-level guy. I would understand the logic on that front. But, like, Minnesota had been mentioned earlier in the year. I don't like that idea for Minnesota because their goal is to win a championship. And Ja, even at his peak, there were fatal flaws in his game that probably limited the upside and limited the ceiling any Ja Morant team was going to have because he's not a good shooter, because he's not a good defender, and because he has to play this heliocentric style in order to get the most out of Ja Morant. And I think that that's bad for some of his teammates. Like, yeah, he can pile up assist numbers, but in terms of getting the most out of a group, I think there are players that I would, I mean, like, I like Darius Garland more as a point guard who's in the middle of their 20s and potentially at a crossroads. I just think Ja at this point is a pretty bad bet. Do you have any favorite teams you would want to send him to?
The Kings. The Kings are the team that I think should trade for Ja Morant is the Kings, because you look at Sacramento talking about not having a lot of paths forward right now. Ja is still a bet. It's a gamble for a team. They can just say, screw it. Well, they have 8 or 9 future first round draft picks, including the Wolves first in 2031. They could trade multiple swaps in a deal like this. DeMar DeRozan, Devin Carter, a former lottery guy, and Dario Saric is lottery filler. And, you know, I think, you know, get 10 years younger from 36-year-old DeMar to 26-year-old Ja, and you give up swaps.
But should you think about Ja as a 26-year-old right now? Because everything we just discussed, it's like he's speed run Allen Iverson's career and is now in the, like, Pistons era of Iverson or the Nuggets era of Iverson. I mean, if you're Sacramento, I mean, it's been pretty dark the last year or two. So I get just rolling the dice and seeing what you have there. But at the same time, 26 years old just feels a little bit misleading when we talk about Ja Morant.
I think that's a good point, right? I mean, like the decline with him, it definitely is a speed run career, as you said, with John. I think ultimately the Kings, 10 years younger, might be a little misleading. DeMar DeRozan being 36 is a very real thing with his performance this year on the defensive end of the floor. But offensively, he still has it. John Moran at 36 might not even be in the NBA. So I think for the Kings, that, you know, I look at the Kings, I'm like, well, what else do they have going? I mean, obviously their own draft pick, you hope you nail that, but they do. I think it's a gamble that's worth at least thinking about, depending on the amount of draft capital they were to give up in this type of configuration. But if it's Devin Carter, you know, plus old DeMar DeRozan in a swap or two swap, that's not a lot for a guy who just, you know, 3-4 years ago was an all-star, a two-time all-star, and felt like the most electric player in the league. I know it's, like, probably not going to pan out, but it's at least a gamble on an upside player.
Yeah, I'm glad your production team prepared the graphic, because I'm looking at the graphic on the screen. The only thing I would cross out is future picks. If I'm Sacramento, I sit there in Sactown and I call Memphis's bluff and say, you don't have anybody else who's interested in Ja Morant. We will take him for nothing. Basically, the Trae Young offer. We're getting off bad deals. We'll take Ja off your hands. Because I think, like, institutionally, Memphis needs to end this chapter and move on. I mean, I think I forget the specifics, but I believe Ja was cursing out the coach in the locker room like 2 months ago, and they had to suspend him, and he was taking all sorts of public shots at him, and like it's just turned into a toxic situation. And the fact that all of this is now public, Shams reporting it last week, signals that there needs to be some sort of break here. So whoever's trading for Ja, I don't think it's such a great opportunity that you have to put picks on the table, and I'm skeptical that there are more than one or two teams out there that you're competing with. So I wouldn't put any assets on the table for Ja.
Well, let's go through some of these other kind of like take a swing teams. DJ May in the YouTube chat, if you're watching us live on YouTube, please give us a like, and feel free to comment with any of your ideas as well. DJ May said, how about quickly and picks for Ja Morant? And that's an idea, basically exactly what I had as well, because in part you have the Stein line who did report that the Raptors made a very similar offer to the Hawks for Trae Young before he was traded to Washington. And so in theory, perhaps maybe you could see the Raptors again try to say, well, you know what, we'll give up a little bit of draft capital in the future with Quickly and salary filler like Grady Dick and go get a Ja Morant. Now, I feel the same exact way that you do about the Kings as I do here with the Raptors, because I think they have like a pretty solid thing going right now. And I think Trey made a little bit of sense because of his perimeter oriented style. Ja, with his interior style, I don't think is a great mesh at all with Scottie Barnes and the existing pieces on the Toronto Raptors. I would not like this if I'm Toronto.
I completely agree. I wouldn't do it if I'm Toronto and I am committed internally to Scottie Barnes for the next 4 or 5 years. I think Scottie is the non-shooter. Totally. Well, and he's been better, and he's expensive too. And so I would say I don't like the fit with Barnes and Ja on the floor together, because Scottie is better with the ball in his hands. And if you're taking the ball out of Scottie's hands and putting it in Ja's hands, I'm not sure how useful Scottie would be in that scenario. And I also think they become easier to guard. If the goal trading for Ja Morant is to make the second round of the playoffs or potentially the Eastern Conference Finals, I think you have to worry about how playoff defenses are matching up with that lineup. And it's basically too many non-shooters on the floor in that scenario.
Now, if you were the Bucks, Andrew, where would you be when it comes to their decisions as the deadline approaches? Because they've been kind of linked to Ja, but they could put an offer on the table. Kuzma, Portis, they could give up if they wanted to their 2026 swap this year. So like in theory, they could give the Grizzlies the rights to that and drop a handful of spots. They could trade their future 2031 first as well. Are you going in this direction if you're Milwaukee, just taking a swing on Ja?
Well, it's hard for me to put myself in John Horst's shoes, because if I were Horst, I would be reading the writing on the wall and concluding that, all right, like the Giannis era has sort of run its course at this point, and we've got at most 4 or 5 more months of this experiment, and I would not want to put a 2031 first on the table to roll the dice with Ja Morant and then potentially be left paying Ja Morant for the next couple of years after Giannis leaves this summer. Just seems kind of crazy to go that direction. However, they are putting their chips down over and over again trying to make this work. And so if that's the plan and that's the approach, I don't know how many other trades are available for Kyle Kuzma and Bobby Portis and the 2026 swap, which isn't great, and like the 2031 first. The 2031 first is a valuable asset. That would be what would scare me away from doing this deal. But I think the Bucks at this point seem pot committed to trying to make it work with Giannis. So I could see them going this direction. I personally would not do it if I were the Bucks front office. What do you think?
I'm with you there. I mean, I'd rather not go for Ja Morant, but at the same time, considering where they are and if they do want to do everything possible, more than they've already done, to try to make it work with Giannis, Ja undeniably does raise your ceiling. He probably also lowers your floor, because I mean, like you said, that 2031 first, I wouldn't want to give that up for Ja Morant. It's too valuable. It maybe throw on a top 10 protection, something like that.
Yeah, I would give up the 2031 first if they're getting a wing to complete the lineup that they have with Giannis right now, because that's what's been sorely lacking for the last year and a half in Milwaukee. So if you can get a credible two-way wing, doesn't have to be an all-star level guy, but somebody who can actually give you a look you feel good about, then, all right, maybe I consider the 2031 first. For Ja, though, it's like almost certainly going to end badly for whoever trades for Ja Morant, which doesn't mean it's like the craziest idea in the world to gamble on him, but I would hold on to the 2031 first if yeah. Ja is on the other end.
My sense is Ja either wants the Miami Heat because it's Miami or the Minnesota mm-hmm. Timberwolves to play with Ant, and I'm not totally certain if there's mutual interest in either of those spots with Miami. I mean, Heat culture, is that a fit for him? It's probably the worst city for him to go to for off-court activities. And then Minnesota, it's an expensive salary for them to pursue. But I am intrigued by the idea of like a broader Ja Morant acquisition, because I think with a fake trade involving Memphis and Minnesota, Jock Landale, if you were able to get him back as part of a deal where you're giving up Nasri, Dante DiVincenzo, Mike Conley, Landale's mm-hmm. a really good backup center who provides toughness, a change from Nasri with his style, interior style. If you can get Scottie Pippen, who hasn't played at all this season, as a good backup point guard for you, Vince Williams in a deal, Morant, Landale, Pippen, Williams, to me, that four for Nasri, DiVincenzo, Mike Conley, Yohan Berenguer, and just one future swap. This is where I'm intrigued for Minnesota, because it's not just Ja. You're getting some pretty solid rotation guys in Landale and Pippen, and even Williams isn't half bad as well. What do you think about this idea for the Timberwolves?
You know, you've piqued my interest, KOC. The idea of Ja going to Minnesota is a little bit concerning to me. I consider myself a part-time Wolves fan, and in theory, I worry that they would have to give up too much of a pretty good rotation in order to make the salaries match. However, if you're giving away Nasri, DiVincenzo, Mike Conley, not the worst thing in the world. You're keeping Jaden McDaniels, you're keeping Julius Randle, you're keeping Gobert, and like the backbone of the team that you already have, and then slotting Ja Morant in. I wouldn't do it if I were them, in large part because I don't trust Ja the higher you go through the Western Conference playoffs. And I think the fit with Ant can work through the regular season, but ultimately just not my favorite, because Ja's a non-shooter that teams are going to be able to guard really, really aggressively in the playoffs. But I like the idea. First of all, I have enjoyed Vince Williams over the last couple of years, and I like the idea of putting him in a playoff rotation. Jock Landale, Scottie Pippen Jr. So you're giving them more pieces in addition to Ja Morant that they can use to go contend for the next couple of years. So it's the best construction of what I still consider a bad idea for the Minnesota Timberwolves.
I think that's a good way to put it. The best construction for a bad idea. With that said, though, he does raise Minnesota's ceiling. He raises their ceiling and lowers the floor. And so for a team in the loaded West, I could see the appeal there, but I'd rather go in a different point guard direction if I'm the Wolves. But do you think, you know, Minnesota should be even trading for a point guard here? They beat the Spurs last night, four lead changes in the final 90 seconds in their comeback against San Antonio. Anthony Edwards is having an unbelievable season, taking another leap as a player. Is that really what Minnesota should be angling for here, an expensive point guard like a Ja, Darius Garland, or is there another direction you're going if you're the Wolves?
You know, first of all, very fun Spurs-Wolves game Sunday night. Anthony Edwards, we're going to talk about underrated players later in the episode here. I think Ant might be a tad underrated at this point in the season, just because he's gotten so much better. And I love year after year, he gets a little bit better, like 15% better each season. And what he's done to improve his skills in the mid-range and as a closer, and we saw it over the final 2 minutes against the Spurs Sunday night. Just awesome stuff from Ant. So shout out to Ant. And I feel good about the Wolves. That's why I wouldn't make like a dramatic, let's add another max player and hope that the distressed asset works out for us and Ja has a whole other chapter of his career ahead of him. I wouldn't do anything that dramatic because Gobert has played so well over the last couple months. Julius Randle was also huge in the fourth quarter against the Spurs Sunday night. They do need another guard, though. So, like, I would try to split the difference. I would make a deal, but I would try to get, like, Ayo Dosunmu from the Bulls or maybe someone like Colin Sexton from the Hornets. Another ball handler, some Mike Conley insurance, somebody to relieve pressure on Ant, at least through the first couple quarters of the game, so that he's not having to create everything on his own. That would be my ideal outcome, again, speaking as a part-time Wolves fan here, because you've really felt the lack of ball handling the last couple playoff runs for them. And so I'd want another option in the backcourt, but I don't know, like the LaMelo idea, the job idea, I probably wouldn't go that direction and rock the boat that much, given how high the baseline has been for Minnesota over the last month or so. What do you
think? Why not even just Scottie Pippen Jr. from Memphis?
That would be
fine.
Forget about Ja. I was looking at Memphis's roster earlier, and I was like, I would rather trade for Cam Spencer if I'm Minnesota than Ja Morant if I'm Minnesota. So some sort of option like that would be great, and I hope that's the direction they go, because I think like a seventh man, an eighth man, could be really useful for them as they try to make a Western Conference Finals run, potentially a Finals run. I think all that's in play without another max guy.
I'm with you there. I think they should go for the mid-salary guard. That's what they should be angling for here, not an expensive Ja Morant type. I think that would end up being a risk that I'd respect to raise your ceiling, but at the same time, I think it would be a risk that would not pay off. Yeah, I get it. But I don't think it would end up being the optimal path moving forward for them. And so, I mean, Trae Young already been traded to your Wizards. Ja Morant seems like he'll be next. Could be having a little bit of a point guard musical chairs right now in the NBA. Do you think LaMelo Ball is going to be next? Or why could the Charlotte situation be different?
I don't know. I mean, the Hornets, when they've had everyone healthy, there's something there, and there's kind of a spark and an energy that hasn't been seen in Charlotte basically my entire life, honestly, when you zoom out and look at this franchise. And so I would let it marinate and see where it goes over the next couple of months here. And then if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And then you try to move LaMelo this summer. And are you going to get anything from LaMelo Ball at this point in his career? Probably not. But I wouldn't try to rip the Band-Aid off now unless I have to. And that's why when I say I don't know, there's like every couple weeks there are reports that LaMelo is unhappy. He's like cursing in the hallway, cursing at his coach in the hallway. I don't know. I don't know whether that's real, but I saw Perk mention something like that on a podcast. There's enough smoke there. I'm just like, I don't know. It sounds like it might be more dysfunctional than it looks on the court when they're healthy. So, if the dysfunction is driving them to make a move now, I would understand it. But just on paper and based on what we've seen when they've been healthy, I wouldn't feel like I have to make a move if I'm Charlotte until potentially making a bigger decision this summer.
I'm with you there. I mean, I think that's spot on. And you mentioned how there's potential, you know, there's something, good, you know, when they're healthy. And I feel like this year, you know, watching Konkan Ipel, Brandon Miller, LaMelo Ball on the floor together, it looks good with the three of them. And statistically, it's great too. If you look at the top offensive ratings, three-man lineup combinations, minimum 230 minutes, the top 13 offensive ratings, Denver, 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 and then Charlotte. So Denver has the top 12 three-man lineup combinations, and then Charlotte with a 127.5 rating.
13 with a bullet. There we go. Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. It's like, you know.
Looks good. right? Like, there's a flow.
It looks
good. They put 124 on the Thunder, Shart.
Exactly. And, you know, Khan is a real thing, and I think has changed the culture a little bit. And he and Brandon Miller, like, this future is bright in Charlotte. Whether LaMelo factors into the future, a completely open question, but he doesn't necessarily take anything off the table for that team if he can stay healthy. I mean, if I were Charlotte, why I would want to move on from LaMelo is mostly related to his health and how difficult it is to plan to compete with a guy who is just unavailable half the time. Or when you look at the last several years, I mean, he's missed a lot of time, and I just don't trust his body more than anything else. But I could see a version of a healthy Hornets team that's actually just a lot of fun to watch over the next couple of years if LaMelo is miraculously more healthy than he has been through the first 5 or 6 years of the decade here.
Yeah, health is the main concern there with LaMelo for sure. I mean, I think the leadership aspect as well, hopefully by committee, they're able to do that. Khan seems like a potential good leader for that team. But ultimately, this trio has something. I would want to see it through this year unless LaMelo were to, like, come out and fully demand a trade. I am curious when it comes to some other guards out there. You mentioned Darius Garland and the Cavaliers earlier. Do you think the Cavaliers should be exploring Darius Garland's trades?
I've wondered whether they would, in large part because the tax bill is going to be so crazy next year that you can just look at the numbers in Cleveland and look at the lack of success through the first half of this season. And it's clear that if something dramatic doesn't change through the second half of the season, they're going to have to break this team up by the time we get to June and July. And so I kind of wonder whether they may try to do something proactively before they hit that point. Garland hasn't been healthy, obviously, for most of this season, but he's started to look more like himself over the last couple of weeks here. And I don't hate that gamble. If Cleveland makes Garland available, I like his potential impact on some of the young teams around the league. I think for a contender, because of the history with his sketchy health and because the defense is just, I mean, he's sort of a liability in any playoff series. I probably wouldn't go that direction if I were a contender. But if I'm a young team and they're trying to get off him, he's the sort of bridge veteran that could be really valuable for teams as they try to go from the lottery to the bottom half of the playoff mix. So I'm high on Garland, relatively speaking, I think, because a lot of people have sort of given up.
You know who I was thinking about? We are in alignment here. The Nets from Michael Porter Jr. Right? Like something like that, because I think Garland could make sense in Brooklyn with their youth. And then for Cleveland, add one of the better shooters in the whole league. And plus, Cleveland has their first in 2031. They have swaps in 30 and 32. They could, you know, sweeten that Garland offer if they needed to for MPJ. I mean, I think that's something that could make mutual sense for both teams. And with Brooklyn, for that side of things, they're sharp. A, he helps your young guys. But also, you could flip that asset again, just like you're flipping MPJ for more.
Yeah.
A year from now to some good team that ends up needing a guard for whatever reason.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, he's a pure point guard. He should make other players better. He should be good for other young guys that you're invested in. And Brooklyn, they have their pick this year, and they need to get a little bit more serious about tanking over the next couple of months. So maybe you trade for Darius Garland and just shut him down and say, get your body right. Let's come back next year. And then, which is exactly what the Wizards are doing with Trae Young, so it's not unprecedented. And then they don't have their pick in 2027. And so if you're going to be competing and trying to win, Garland could help you do that and can help kind of raise the floor for some of these young, hopeless organizations around the NBA. It's honestly a very reasonable idea. I think other teams may be willing to put picks on the table for Michael Porter Jr., and maybe that's more attractive to Brooklyn, but I love that idea.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's possibly more attractive ideas out there for Brooklyn. Then again, like Garland is an all-star player. He's still young. So if you get mm-hmm. that and picks for MPJ, I'm sure a lot of Cavs fans would say, there's no way we should do that. Why would we do that? Who's going to be our point guard? And I understand that argument. There'd be more to figure out. You'd probably have to flip DeAndre Hunter in another deal for a different guard as well to have part of your rotation. But for Cleveland, I do think they should be exploring Garland trades, even if nothing actually ends up working out there. And I think right now, this morning, Andrew, a lot of Rockets fans are talking about point guards as well. Because if you look at the Western Conference standings, well, what do you know? In early January, January 12th, who's ahead of Houston in the standings? The Phoenix Suns. The Suns are ahead of the Houston Rockets in the standings right now, as the Houston continues to be a below 500 team since December 1st, and the Suns, without KD, without Bradley Beal, are continuing to surge. Does a point guard solve Houston's issues? Because it seems to me that's what Ime Udoka thinks. Everything that he's been talking about without KD on the floor, what's actually their big problem right now?
Well, can I ask you, do you think this is basketball karma at work with Kevin Durant after a week ago he came out, he hits the game winner to beat Phoenix, and then comes out and talks about how emotionally satisfying it was to have that moment because Phoenix, they were the first team in his career to push him out the door and say, we don't want you anymore. Something to that effect. And I recall hearing that press conference and thinking to myself, that's not really what happened. And you, since he got there, like he was such a bad leader and wanted out himself. It wasn't like purely Phoenix pushing him out the door. And I just thought his framing was so misleading that perhaps this is the basketball gods smiting the Rockets for a week or so here to punish Kevin Durant for that quote. Do you buy that theory?
I mean, if karma is real, that very well could be what's going on.
Could be what's happening.
it also could be the fact that he left a team with a 3-1 lead in the Western Conference Finals for the team that had the 3-1 comeback in the Warriors. It could go all the
Pretty
way back
tricky
to that.
Karma record for Kevin Durant. When you zoom out over the last decade, it's a good point. In terms of Houston, I like their team. I actually like watching them because they don't have the right pieces. And so it's interesting to me to watch them try to figure it out on a nightly basis and try to make it work despite the poor roster construction. But they clearly need another guard. And right now, I mean, they're relying too much on Jabari Smith Jr. and Tari Eason to shoot well and be the guards that they're looking for.
Jabari Smith can't hit anything. Did you see his quote after the game? I think it was Saturday's game where he went like 1-for-8 from three. And he's like, well, what's wrong with the team? He's like, Jabari Smith needs to make threes.
Did he say that?
He said that about himself.
Or Jabari Smith?
No, Jabari Smith said that about himself.
Good self-awareness. So that's a start for 2026. But yeah, he can't hit anything. And, you know, when he hits shots, they actually look like a semi-normal basketball team. But when he doesn't, you really feel the lack of perimeter options beyond Kevin Durant and occasionally Reed Shepard, although Ime kind of yanks his minutes around depending on the night. So I think it's time for them to add somebody.
What is with the Udoka love affair with Aaron Holiday? My God.
I don't get it. I think it's kind of an old school coach thing. Like, you see their offense. Reed Shepard, even when he's not shooting well, defenses sell out to stop him on the perimeter, and it gives the rest of the offense room to breathe. But every time it looks like Reed is turning a corner and, you know, there's some real momentum there, you'll look up and it'll be like, well, he played 16 minutes last night. And so I don't know what tests he has to pass in order to become like a dependable member of Ime's rotation, but whatever they are, we're 4 months into the season and he hasn't passed it.
I'm not quite sure exactly how to divvy up the pie here for the blame. Like, but I think it's shared with Udoka. The offensive system looks very clunky. The defense looks like it's just not playing with the intensity that it was early in the season. How much of that is Ime? How much of that is KD's lack of leadership again popping up like it did at Brooklyn, like it did at Phoenix. How much of that is just the personnel? How much of this is on Rafael Stone finding a lack of elite shooters on the team? How much of it is the fact that Dorian Finney-Smith looks like a complete shell of his former self as a guy who was supposed to be an elite 3-and-D wing? I mean, there's a lot of, you know, ways you can point your finger at the Rockets right now. And I think ultimately, with the hand that Ime was dealt with this roster, Fred VanVleet getting hurt before the season, I just don't think he's A, trusting Reed enough. I think he should be feeling that out more rather than leaning on Aaron Holiday, a proven average commodity. But I also do think there is an element of maybe they do need an upgrade at the guard spot here with a more proven guy. But who is that? What do you trade to go out and get that? Because anything you give, whether it's trading Jabari Smith, something of value, you're losing a really good, versatile forward. So I'm not quite sure the direction to go if I'm the Rockets here. But I'm also not quite sure Ime is the right coach. I'm not sensing a lot of accountability with his press conferences. It's a lot of pointing at the players with the loss they suffered on, I think, Friday or Saturday. He's like, well, we can't go more than 2 minutes without a 37-year-old. So, well, why is that? Yeah. I mean, is that because of your lineup choices? Is that because of your offensive system? Is that because of your coaching? Or is it just because KD's off the floor? I don't think it's just because KD's off the floor. I watched that stretch of the game and that blowing that 13-point lead without KD out there. I don't think it was just mentally weak, as he said. It looked like a team that lacked any organization out on the floor at all, and that is in part on the head coach.
Yeah, you know, that's a good take. It's funny because I, over the years, have come to enjoy Ime's fire and brimstone press conferences, because if you look out at the league, Ime is one of the only coaches that is willing to just like rip into his players after losses. And so I kind of enjoy the takes, but the takes are rarely reflecting on his own shortcomings. And I think that's definitely part of the story. And look, there were parts of last year's playoff loss to the Warriors where I felt like some of the decisions he made in that series put the Rockets at a little bit of a disadvantage. And so, yeah, he could be the coach that gets them from point A to point B, but may not be the right guy to get them from point B to point C, where they're actually contending in the West and actually pushing a team like the Thunder and pushing their way to the finals. It is also, just as a baseline, when you're relying on this much from a 37-year-old player in Kevin Durant, like, there are going to be weird losses, and that's kind of baked into the equation. It's one of the reasons a lot of people were skeptical of the Rockets coming into this season, because I think KD, his numbers have been great over the last several years, but he's just not the same guy he was, obviously, like 6 or 7 years ago. And what would concern me if I were a Rockets fan is they haven't even had the like fluke KD injury where he misses a month and they have to make it work without him. But that has been kind of a routine thing over the last several seasons as well. So, yeah, it's kind of I wouldn't say it's a dire situation, because if you put them across most of the other teams in the West, most of the other good teams, most of their losses have been to bad teams this year. They can match up pretty well and are physically imposing, but just making it through the regular season without some of these brain dead losses could get interesting over the next couple of months here. And they could be in a situation where they are seventh or sixth going into the Western Conference playoffs, which puts them at a meaningful disadvantage.
Andrew, have you purchased your Trae Young jersey yet?
No. I saw Joe House purchase a Trae Young jersey. He went to a Wizards Pelicans game and showed up on Twitter with a Wizards jersey. I don't think I could go that direction yet. Maybe I'll get there though before next season. Who can say? Are you in on the trade? Do you like the trade from a national perspective?
I mean, I just hope it doesn't take away from some of the young guys on this Wizards roster, the Keyshawn George and Trey Johnson types. And, you know, I just hope it's additive to the youth and not a subtraction to their development, because I really like some of the young guys on Washington.
Yeah. I mean, look, my objections to the trade, I saw a lot of peers in media. I don't know if you were one of them, KOC. I didn't listen to the show last week, so I don't know whether you were on this bandwagon. A lot of folks were marveling at the asset management of the Wiz, going from Bradley Beal a couple years ago to Trae Young now. Really, all they've done is take bad deals and bad ideas for the last couple of years, and they got a 2030 pick swap out of it with Phoenix that could be interesting. But, like, going from Bradley Beal to Trae Young isn't something to celebrate if you don't think Trae Young is good. And I don't think Trae Young is good. And so my worry is exactly what yours is. There's a lot of ways you can look at this and say, well, the Wizards have $80 million in cap space. They have to spend it on somebody. There's not really a downside here. The downside is that, like, Trae in Atlanta, at least, imposed a style, a heliocentric style of offense on that team that marginalized everybody else who was on that team. And we've seen Jalen Johnson has broken out without Trae there. And I think the risk is that the Trae style is bad for the development of Trae Johnson, who's been really solid over the last couple weeks, and Keyshawn George, and even Alex Sarr, although Alex Sarr should get some easy buckets with Trae in the mix. People talk about what a terrible defender Trae Young is, but I could live with a horrendous defense. It's actually the offense that stresses me out over the next couple years, because I know they're going to give him an extension. I hope it's not too horrifying, but all of this is what's keeping me from buying a Trae Young jersey and celebrating the new era in our nation's capital. Perhaps I'll get there and be arm in arm with Joe Howe sometime soon. Who can say?
Who knows? Who can say? We'll see it in time. We'll see if he even plays a game with the Wizards the remainder of this season.
That could be the biggest immediate value of Trae is CJ McCollum was actually really solid for Washington and they were winning too much. And so if Trae, he's got like an MCL thing and a quad contusion, who knows what else they'll invent
rest
over the next 3 or 4 months.
Rest up, Trae.
Exactly.
Get healthy.
Trae, get
we
your
need
body
you.
Right. That's right. And
we
let's
need
secure
you next
a
year,
top
Trae.
Three pick. All of that is what's most important to my personal well-being and sanity. So let's just keep the first round pick for Washington. And then next year, I'm ready to end the tanking chapter. And so maybe Trae will help us compete. Who can say? He could be like a Rudy Gobert, Julius Randle type valuable veteran that raises the floor for everybody. That, I guess, is the dream scenario.
And we'll be right back after this break. Time for the underrated player draft. Andrew, I texted you in advance some rules for our underrated player draft here. Our goal is to build the best team of underrated players, however you define underrated. So it's your own personal definition, but no rookies are allowed, no former All-Stars, no former All-NBA. Positions don't matter. Five players. You get the first pick in the underrated player draft. Who are you taking?
Okay, so you texted me this over the weekend. You said it's positionless, but you said the goal of the exercise is to build the better team of underrated players. So I tried to build a coherent roster, and my first pick, I am taking a big man. I don't see that many big men out there across the 30 teams that are underrated. However, Jalen Duren has never made an All-Star game. He's never made an All-NBA team. And he's a big guy that I feel great about anchoring my team, my starting five of underrated players. He's gotten so much better as a scorer this year. Very good on the boards. Not dominant defensively, but solid defensively. He's not going to get you killed by any means at the five. And he's also like, he's kind of a decent decision maker going downhill on the pick and roll and a good pick and roll partner for any guard. So there is maybe some debate about whether he qualifies as underrated because there's been a lot of Jalen Duren celebration early this season. But I still think everybody talks about Cade like he's just playing with nobody in Detroit. And he's an MVP because look at their roster. Jalen Duren is like a legit all-star this year. And so because everybody talks about the Detroit situation like it's trash and Cade Cunningham, I'm going to say he's still a little bit underrated, and he's my number one pick. What do you think?
I think that's a good choice, and you and I are thinking very much along the same lines, because Detroit is such a good story this year, and everybody's mm-hmm. talking about Cade with his performance, and of course, people are giving love to some of the other guys, but it's not, I think, on the level that it will be come playoff time if the Pistons make a deep run, which is why with my first pick, I'm taking Isaiah Stewart. Isaiah Stewart Ooh. Is underrated, Sharp, way underrated, 37% from three.
I love the pick.
It's a really good pick. His last 3 years. And so people think about Isaiah Stewart as this guy, a tough guy who can shoot, good at rim finisher and all that too. But in reality this year, he's become an all-defensive player candidate. He's a dominant defensive player, both as a help defender at the rim, but also in man-to-man defense as well this season. So yeah. I have a stat for you. 110 players have defended at least 75 isolations this year. Isaiah Stewart is number one in the NBA. 0.68 points allowed per isolation. He's locked down guys like Mitchell and KD. He's switched on to bigs and guards and wings. He's versatile. So not only does he shoot threes as a big, not only does he finish at an elite rate at the rim, not only does he block shots at the rim, he's become a great switch defender. Isaiah Stewart, one of the most underrated players in the whole league.
Oh, my God. What a pick, KOC. I considered going with Isaiah Stewart, beef stew. And the reason I considered it, I think Jalen Duren's better, but beef stew is a better defender than Jalen Duren, and he does stretch the floor a little bit. And the reason he's underrated is because a lot of people think of him as like a meme, like him trying to fight LeBron, him trying to start for this brawler. But he's really refined his game. And when you watch Pistons games, they throw a lot of stats at you about his very, like the at rim defense, all sorts of stuff that he's doing, similar to the stats that you read out there. So I do think he's one of the most underrated players in the league. My second pick, Denny Avdija. Again, right on the line, because there's been a lot of Denny love over the last couple of months, but he's never made an all-star game, never made an all-NBA team, and he just puts so much pressure on the rim for that Blazers team. I love, like, people complain about him getting to the line too much. He's a grifter, this, that, and the other thing. A lot of the time he's getting to the line, it's because he's just putting his head down and going straight into the lane and getting good looks at the rim, finishing through contact. I think he leads the league in and ones through the first couple months here. And he's a good shooter from the outside. And I think his defense has slipped a little bit, but he's solid defensively and not somebody you worry about on that end. So just a big fan of Denny and what his game has grown into. Particularly from like 4 or 5 years ago, watching him in DC, it's kind of mind blowing watching him turn into like a bona fide star for the Blazers.
Did you
so
see
far.
This coming?
I did. We started to see this version of Denny his final season in Washington.
Yeah, that fourth and final year, right?
Exactly. Like the final couple months in Washington, it was like, whoa. What is this? Is this real? And then he got traded, and we found out since he's come to Portland that like it is very real. First couple years, though, he looked very raw offensively, and I did not see any of this coming at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think with him, this was kind of the dream when he was playing overseas, what he's turned into now in Portland. He's turned into the best version that you could have expected when he was taken in the top 10. My next pick for our underrated player draft, Keyonte George looks like a future all-star. So he's my pick here. He's probably not underrated on this podcast. Talked about him a ton, but 24-7-4 this season, 43% off the catch from 3-point range, 3-level scorer, the ability to get to the rim, finish with either hand, the mid-range game as well, floater range, and from 3-point range, both off the catch and off the dribble, he's shown good progress. And I think with Keyonte George, I don't think he's a good stats, bad team player. I think he's legitimately good, and that this follows a year-to-year trajectory that he's been on going back to college. And so I'm very optimistic about what Keyonte George has done this year for a losing Jazz team. And I think next year is when he'll eventually become recognized for this actual development, assuming the Utah Jazz don't continue to suck and they're a bit more competitive next year.
Were you high on him in the draft? Did you see this coming for him?
I fluctuated. I was very much like, I think I had him ranked as high as fourth or fifth, and then I dropped him down to 13 or 14 because as the draft approached with him, there was concerns about his conditioning. And that's not never a good thing at that time. And even early in his career, that's something he needed to get better at. And he did get better at. He has more burst off the dribble now than he did as a rookie. And that's in part because of the shape he's got himself into. And so with Keyonte George, I do think like he was very much a love him or hate him prospect in the draft among executives. And I kind of felt that way with myself as well as I was establishing my board that year, but he's looked great. So that's my second pick. Who do you have next?
He has been so good, and I wish Utah weren't they need to keep their pick too, but I would love to see what Will Hardy could do, even with the group they have now, if they wanted to compete around Lowry and Keyonte George, in large part because Keyonte George has been so good. It'd be like, all right, let's see what they have here. Unfortunately, I'm sure that's not the direction the Jazz will go. My next pick is Trey Murphy for the Pelicans. He has just been on one for the last couple of weeks here, and I want to get him out of New Orleans so that he can play meaningful basketball for the first time in his career. But I love what he could give to basically any offense. And we've seen him have a little bit more agency this year and a lot more volume this year. And he's responded well to that opportunity. So there are literally like 10 good teams around the NBA who I would love to see put some real valuable picks on the table to go get Trey Murphy. In lieu of that, I'm adding him to my underrated squad here and feel very good about Trey Murphy at three.
I thought about Trey Murphy and then I was like, is he actually underrated?
It's or fair.
Everybody wants Trey Murphy. Literally everybody. Trey Murphy. Take him out of New Orleans.
One could make the argument that people like you and me have now been talking so much about Trey Murphy for the last couple of years, he's a little bit overrated. I don't think he's overrated because I think when you look at what he's done.
That's a slightly biased belief. Slightly biased on my podcast last time he was on. He's like, I think every player in the NBA is both overrated and underrated.
It's very difficult. The internet has made it difficult to identify genuinely underrated players because there's always dorks like you and me who are talking of guys like years before they're actually good and good enough to contend. But I think he's got offensive upside that isn't fully appreciated by the mainstream. And also, most people just haven't watched Trey Murphy play basketball for the last 4 years because he's been relegated to New Orleans. So let's get him to San Antonio. San Antonio, no excuse for not putting some of the future assets you've got on the table to add Trey Murphy and really go for it for the next couple of years. They're the team that should do it.
I'm 100% with you. Like somebody should go over the top and go get Trey Murphy. And that's where I think he actually probably is underrated because people are like, oh, we'll give you two picks. No. Like you need to give up more than two picks for Trey Murphy. Like this guy is an elite high-end role player who shows flashes of doing a bit more than just role player stuff with what he can do off the dribble in his development year to year. So kind of along those lines, my next pick, Peyton Watson this season, 13 points per game, 5 boards, very good defense. This is a guy at UCLA 4 years ago at this time was averaging 3.3 points per game. He goes 30th in the draft as a raw prospect, becomes a really solid rotation guy for the Denver Nuggets, but he's become a great 3-and-D guy. 41% this year from three-point range. And then without Jokic, the stuff he's doing off the dribble. Coming into the season, he had a career high of 24 points. He's averaging 23.7 points per game his last 8 games, running way more pick and roll, scoring out of isolations, 1.03 points per pick and roll without Jokic. He's running 15.7 pick and rolls per 100 possessions without Jokic on the floor to 1.6 when Jokic is on the floor. So his usage is just times 15 pretty much without Jokic out there. They're putting the ball in his hands. He's showing that he's more than just an open catch and shoot three guy, showing he's more than just a versatile defender, more than a guy who cuts to the rim. That this is a guy who has more layers to his game that he's developed as a player off the dribble. And I think it's the latest example of how without Jokic, there's some silver linings happening here in Denver, with Peyton Watson being one of them.
Does the apology to Calvin Booth need to be as loud as the disrespect was? Because we've also had some Zeke Nagy flashes recently.
Oh my gosh.
Jalen Pickett having some nights for them. I don't know. The supporting cast.
Even though Calvin Booth threw me under the bus, which was very unfair, it was an on-the-record interview with him.
That's true. You don't personally owe an apology to Calvin Booth.
I still supported Booth over Malone through my podcast and my writing, because I always felt like Malone was the guy who was playing, who wasn't playing Christian Brown on their run to the finals until Bones Highland was traded. He's the guy who was just killing the confidence of Zeke Nagy, who wasn't giving consistent opportunity to their youth, who didn't want to play Jalen Pickett or Hunter Tyson, barely wanted to play Peyton Watson, was playing guys on two-way contracts instead to spite Calvin Booth. Malone put the relationship with the GM ahead of what was best for the team in the current, in the present, in the future. But ultimately, Booth's decision to go with some of these young guys, some of whom Tim Conley drafted. Conley took Peyton Watson. These decisions.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
I thought were the correct path. And I think we're seeing that right now with Adelman now at head coach, Jokic out, Holmes, who was a Booth draft pick, Zeke Nagy, who he re-signed, and Peyton Watson getting this opportunity. These guys look great, man. Like, the Nuggets look really competitive even without Jokic. They look great.
I agree with you. Malone deserves more blame for the way some of these guys plateaued early on. And if you go back and read the article that launched the controversy, the KOC Calvin Booth controversy, a lot of the logic that he's laying out there makes sense. In order to contend year over year with a guy like Jokic, you do have to invest in some of these young guys and hope that they hit. And they just weren't really given any opportunity to blossom over the last couple of years. And so these Jokic-less games in Denver are an opportunity to let those guys spread their wings and see what you have. So it should be interesting to see whether they're able to stay afloat. And it's been, honestly, a lot more encouraging early on than I expected when Jokic went down. I have a pick, though, in the underrated draft. I think OG Anunoby is slightly underrated in New York City. OG? Yeah, exactly.
Underrated?
Here's the thing. Everyone thinks about Brunson. Everyone thinks about Cat. OG is so solid as a corner three-point shooter and point-of-attack defender. He's the reason I am reluctant to dismiss the Knicks. Cat is the reason I'm tempted to dismiss the Knicks. But I think OG, there was a point where people were hoping, oh man, like, he could blossom into an all-star. He could be the next Kawhi. And that was sort of a conversation before every single season in Toronto. And it never really happened. But what he has turned into is one of the most valuable role players in the entire NBA. And we saw it in the NBA Cup run. And he's the reason I look at New York and say, they are probably pound for pound the most talented team in the Eastern Conference. Whereas, like, Mikal Bridges, when the chips are down, I don't really trust Mikal Bridges. When the chips are down, I do trust OG to match up with basically anyone on the other side. And he's not going to be dominant, but he's going to be very, very solid for New York. So he is my last pick, or my second to last pick, excuse me. What do you think? Am I pushing the definition of underrated?
Maybe. I think this team looked pretty depleted without Josh Hart. I would have liked OG Anunoby to absorb some of that energy and on the court, but he's just not the type of player. I mean, Josh Hart is actually the underrated one. on the Knicks.
He could be. Yeah.
Could be.
I mean, Josh Hart's gotten a lot of love for being underrated over the last couple of years. He may be so underrated, he's overrated. Who can say? There's definitely OG, if you're asking him to be like a number one, number two guy, he's going to constantly leave you disappointed. But as a 3-4 on the pecking order, I really like OG and think he'd make a lot of good teams great. So we'll see.
I'm going to take another wing here. Keldon Johnson. Keldon Johnson is a sixth man of the year candidate this year. He is dominant scoring at the basket, shooting 57% total from the field, 69% in the restricted area so far this season, hitting 53% of his floater range shots as well. And basically ignoring the mid-range. If he's driving into the arc, he's getting into the paint. He's a great rebounder, getting 6 rebounds per game this year for the Spurs and only 23-24 minutes per game. And he's making 42% of his three-pointers. And so you put all this together. Keldon Johnson, great downhill attacker, great floater game, great rebounder, great three-point shooter, solid decision maker as a passer, solid as a defender as well. He's a sixth man of the year candidate for the Spurs this year. There's a lot of talk about Wemby and their guards. Not a lot of talk about Keldon Johnson with how good he's been so far this year.
Did you consider Harrison Barnes at all based on the first couple months of the season?
Okay. No, I mean, I mean, he's probably been underrated, this year, because he's been so solid for San Antonio. But lean towards Keldon Johnson because Barnes is a bigger name, former champion. A lot of people know the name Harrison Barnes.
I like the Keldon pick in part because a lot of people, when they point to the San Antonio supporting cast and say, "Oh, look at all the improvements," they point at Steph Castle. They point at Harrison Barnes and what his three-point shooting can open up for the offense, and obviously Fox. But Keldon does get lost in those conversations. And if you're watching the Spurs, he's helpful almost every night and has been really good and was somebody I was very excited about like a couple years ago. And then he kind of flatlined. He was out of shape for a little while there. And so watching him round into a useful rotation piece on a really good Spurs team has been a pretty cool story. My last pick with the underrated draft, got to give some love to Ryan Rollins for the Milwaukee Bucks. Probably the most classically underrated player on my roster. I just love what this dude can do. And it's frustrating because the other pieces in Milwaukee are such a mess outside of like Giannis and Miles Turner. But the size that he has at the point guard position, the decision making has gotten a lot better this year. The shooting has gotten a lot better this year. And when you get him into the lane, he's good finishing around the rim. And he, is a deflection master on defense, just generating all sorts of good stuff defensively. And so I hope that either the baseline of Milwaukee is raised to where they're actually playing like meaningful games down the stretch, or if it's not going to happen in Milwaukee and they end up moving on from Giannis, I hope he lands with another good team because I think he's the sort of role player that could help contending teams year after year after year. And he's another former Wizard. Would not have guessed it would go this direction for Ryan Rollins, but he's turned into like a super valuable piece for Milwaukee. So we'll see.
That's a great choice. I like the Ryan Rollins pick. And for my final pick, Pat Spencer gets all the love. Warriors, big market, lacrosse star. Cam Spencer is the better Spencer. So Cam Spencer is my final pick here because of 101
Spencer
players.
Is the better Spencer.
He is. 101 players
what a take.
This year.
It's true.
they're taking 5+ threes, Andrew. Spencer's number one in the NBA in 3-point percentage, making almost 47% of his threes. He's 48% on catch and shoot threes this year, 44% on pull up 3-pointers as well. He's 60%. On pull-up 2-pointers for the Grizzlies this year. And he loves using that mid-range area of the floor, not just the score, but as a playmaker as well. He's averaging 5.3 assists this year to only 1.5 turnovers. Great decision maker, kicking the ball out, finding shooters, finding cutters. Cam Spencer, to me, might be the most underrated player in the whole NBA. So far this year with what he's done for a mid-bad weird, ugly Grizzlies team, but Cam Spencer is one of the bright spots and at a minimum looks like one of the steals of the second round in recent years.
Closing out the draft with a take. The most underrated player in the NBA, Cam Spencer, the better Spencer. I like it, man. Pat Spencer, maybe a tad overrated after being underrated for the last couple of years. The Bay really in on Pat Spencer. Cam Spencer, though, never starred on the lacrosse field the way his brother did. Did win a national title at UConn. And look, they're a Baltimore family. Tim Connelly, also from Baltimore. A lot of roots in Baltimore. Once again, going to reiterate, Minnesota, do not trade for Ja Morant. Minnesota, if you have to put picks on the table, bring back Cam Spencer. You know, let him supercharge the Ant era. He's been great. He's been so good in Memphis the last, like, 6 weeks. I don't know how much to trust any of this with Cam Spencer. He could definitely be a useful rotation piece, but I wonder whether, like, the clock will strike midnight at some point on some of the shooting and how valuable he's been offensively. But yeah, definitely been rock solid so far this year. So we'll see where it goes. All the players who are on bad teams, I want them on good teams, particularly Cam Spencer and Trey Murphy, because I'd like to see what it does, what it looks like if they're actually playing meaningful basketball.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely going to be – I mean, it's, look, just hearing you say that the Wolves should trade for Cam Spencer and not Ja Morant, it's not crazy. It's not crazy. They should. And it's not crazy. They should try to go over the top for Cam Spencer. He'd be a great fit next to Anthony Edwards in that backcourt. I'll tell you that for sure. And you see on screen our teams here, just to recap, Andrew's team, Denny Avdia, Jalen Duren, OG Anunoby, Trey Murphy, Ryan Rollins, my team, Isaiah Stewart, Keontae George, Peyton Watson, Keldon Johnson, Cam Spencer. I'd love for you to leave a comment with whose team you think is better. Who do you think is the most underrated player in the NBA as well? The non-all-star, non-all-NBA edition, and non-rookie edition as well. It was all part of our exercise today. Andrew, I'll tell you what's clear going through this, thinking through players to take and put on my team, there are a lot of underrated players, and I think there's a lot of assets out there that teams should be targeting, whether it's a Cam Spencer type, to try to go over the top this year. But this is fun, man. We talked about a lot. Point guard, musical chairs, underrated players. I hope the Trae Young experience goes well for you. I really do.
Yeah, not going to be buying any jersey anytime soon, but the Cam Spencer to the Wolves movement, it started today.
A Trey shirt?
No t-shirt jersey. Nope. I'm all set.
I'm not optimistic. Bootleg Trey shirts outside the arena, you know, for $15-$20.
Oh, one of those? God. Like an ice Trey shirt, do something with his nickname. Nope, out on all of it.
How about you grow a scraggly beard like Trey?
No, I'm not going to start. Look, I may start balding in honor of Trey to celebrate the era here, but we'll see. Can't be much worse. Look, honestly, can't be much worse than what the Wizards have had for the last 8 years of my life. So I guess that's a silver lining here, and maybe they'll start to win next season. For now, it's been great to see you, and I'm going to continue to just bandwagon the Minnesota Timberwolves, and maybe they'll get Cam Spencer. Regardless, they have Anthony Edwards, who's been freaking phenomenal over the last couple of months here.
Well, thank you, Andrew, for joining me today. Everybody can check out The Greatest of All Talk, Sharp China, Sharp Tech over at Stratechery, everything that you do with Ben Thompson and the Stratechery podcast network. All right, coming up, it's Draft Class with my guest, Mo Farah. All right, it's time for Draft Class. Joining us today, Mo Farah, draft analyst over on X. Mo, how are you?
Hey, man. Thanks so much for having me. I'm super excited.
So, Mo, I've followed your work for a long time over on social media. You're at MCF NBA. I think like your analysis, the videos you post, the breakdowns, all very insightful. So I wanted to bring you on the show today to talk about a bunch of different topics around the draft and with your top five. No surprises, you know, with your top three. The order is different for everybody. Darren Peterson, Cam Boozer, AJ DiBonsa in the top three. And then fourth, you have Quaintance at Kentucky, and then Kingston Fleming's with the fifth pick, on your board that you posted on December 31st. My prediction is, based off of the way in which you post about Fleming's, is that your next update, you're going to have Fleming's moved up to fourth. That would be my bet.
And you know what? You, if you're a betting man, that's correct. I would 100% have Fleming's moving forward ahead of Jane Quinn's. Fleming's has just been on his hair this season, to say the least. And, you know, he's really been the fulcrum for Houston basketball this season, which is crazy to say as a freshman in a Kelvin Sampson system. You know, you wouldn't expect, you know, a guy to just come in right away and just be very integral in their success. And Kingston Fleming's has done that as PG1 in this class. In my eyes, he's been somebody that really just took the nation by storm, just scoring at a high level, being a really effective defender. And yeah, he's just been the guy in Houston. And you could see it down the stretch when it comes to, you know, conference play, a lot of the high leverage games that Houston's been playing, which they've been playing a pretty loaded schedule. And, you know, down the stretch, he's been the guy that's had the ball in his hands while also being very impactful as a defender. And yeah, I mean, as you see the tweet right here, I'm not sure if there's a better prospect that gets their spots than Houston's Kingston Fleming. And by my next update, he most 100% will be PG1. So yeah, what are your thoughts on him?
I mean, the game against Texas Tech, I'm pretty sure that post you made was during that game. Some of the shots he hit from mid-range, the ability to just contort his body mid-air as he's elevating for his shot, the diversity in the shots that he could take from mid-range, at the rim, from three-point range, off the dribble, off the catch. He looks like a three-level scorer, and you've written about his improvement as a shooter. Can you get into what he was at the high school level as a shooter versus what he has been so far for Houston as a freshman guard?
Yeah, I mean, at the high school level in Texas, he was somebody that, you know, he was shooting the ball at a very great clip, you know, upwards to some 40% as a three-point shooter. And I think for me, the thing that's really excited me the most with Fleming's development is really just the off the dribble, right? You know, he's being able to create, you know, in the half court, where, you know, he was really effective in the transition in AAU circuit. But I think something that's really taken a step is kind of the lead guard stuff, which, you know, coming into the season, I was really fond of him as a guard prospect, and just kind of the rookie class that they had coming in with him, Isaiah Harwell, Chris Sinak Jr. But I really didn't expect kind of this growth to happen in year one. You know, I was looking at Fleming as kind of like a two-year guy, you know, and being able to say, like, is the shot going to develop? That's kind of the swing for me. But he's been somebody that has been able to do that, shooting at an exceptional level, you know, super efficient in, you know, a sub 70% true shooting. But it's also the stuff that he's being able to do in terms of the mid-range and two-point scoring. You know, he's been able to get to his spots, whether that's at the rim, just overall being super high level as an effective rim scorer. He's able to score at 70% at the rim, and as well being 78% on dunks. So he's just been super effective at getting to his spots. And I think the shooting is really what has been remarkable for me off the dribble. And I think being able to say, like, can you really see lead guard potential for a guy like Fleming's, where, you know, he already offers you a lot off the ball. You know, playing with this kind of guard prospect of Emmanuel Sharp, Milo Suzan. He's a guy that can play with the ball in his hands, without the ball in his hands, super effective as a defender. So, I mean, the ceiling is endless for a guy like him. And, you know, I was having a discussion with somebody about Fleming's, like, early on in the season. I was saying he's very Kasan Wallace coded in terms of, you know, the 6'4", two-way guard that can really shoot the ball at a high level. But, you know, I think he surpassed that. And, you know, as you see right here, he is quite the talent. And he's been able to show that in high leverage games and very early on in conference play for Houston. So yeah, he's really shown a lot of growth in the shooting, particularly off the dribble and just getting to his spots, whether that's at the 2-point, in the mid range, or at the rim.
You mentioned he's listed at 6'4". Back in 2023, he measured at 6'1.5". Maybe he's grown a little bit since then. I don't think he's actually 6'4". And this is where, like, I you know, playing devil's advocate here. In 2024, Reed Sheppard, 6'1.75". Rob Dillingham, 6'1". In 2023, Scoot Henderson, 6'2.5". Kasan Wallace, 6'2.5". In 2021, Davion Mitchell, 6' flat. These are guys like similar height, drafted in the top 10 the last 4 or 5 years. Are there any concerns there that you have with Flemings, with the lack of size that he has, given the ups and downs for some of those smaller guards that were lottery level prospects with a return on value when it comes to projecting him moving forward in the NBA?
100%. I mean, you really see the impact of size, whether that's, you know, given the frame, whether the wingspan, it's very important and really integral in a player. And I think for a guy like Flemings, where, you know, you kind of saw this last year with a guy like LeBaron Fylde, who very similarly profiled in like that two-way POA lead creator guard kind of mold, where, you know, last season we really saw Fylde, who came into the season, I think, presumed at 6'4", and then, you know, come to the test and he was, you know, on the lower end of 6'3", and very light, you know, which that's kind of the case for Flemings. I think it was last reported he was like 190 pounds. So, you know, I think frame is super important, especially for the lead guard, and kind of projecting what does the two-way upside look like if he's kind of on the thinner side, or if he's not able to kind of take physicality on the court. But, you know, he's really able to show that at a high level, being able to get downhill, actually initiate contact and absorb it. So, you know, he looks like he plays through the strength, and the tape shows that. But I think to your point, you know, these are some of the qualms that we were seeing with a guy, for example, like Reed Shepard, where, you know, he really struggled, you know, in his first year being able to even just get on the court. You know, we already know how high level of a shooter he was, how exceptional of a defender off the ball he was in college. But, you know, really that doesn't matter if you're not able to effectively get picked on in the league. And I think that's all that you really have to think about with prospects, is kind of just projecting them out into, you know, regular season basketball, playoff basketball. These guys are ultimately going to get picked on if you don't necessarily have the skills and tools, but ultimately the frame to match up athletically. And I think with a guy like Flemings, who clearly he has a lot of skill on both ends of the ball, it's really just, does the frame hold up and he's able to kind of handle the physicality in the league? And I think he's protecting that really well so far through early conference play. But again, the NBA is a different monster, and it's just a matter of being able to, can you penetrate lead defenses on both ends with that frame? And I think you can answer that, Bill. I think 6'3", 190. And like I said, Houston is no joke of a strength program. So I think he's in the perfect system to actually handle physicality and really just hone in defensively. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's all true. And I think with him, like, once I assemble my big board, I don't know. I mean, like, I'm not quite sure I'd go that high with him. I think, like, he's seems to be rising on everybody's board. He's, you know, top five in a lot of places, top 10 at a minimum, it seems like, almost everywhere. But that measurement come May at the draft combine with what he weighs and his actual height, I think that's going to be a bit telling. I mean, with what he actually is, because 6'4 feels a lot different than, oh, 6'1.5 without shoes. He's actually only 6'3 with shoes. We'll see how that pans out. And I think with small guards in the NBA, I mean, look, the top three guys, you know, AJ DiBonsa at 6'9" is a primary initiator. Darren Peterson at 6'6", you hope, is a primary initiator. Cam Boozer at 6'9", 6'10", 250 whatever pounds is a guy that's going to help facilitate. Creation comes from all these different positions with players of different shapes and sizes. It doesn't, no longer has to be a small guard in the NBA nowadays. And I think you see the challenges and the value for Trae Young and the difficulty of getting something for Ja Morant and some of these smaller guards. I do have some hesitations when it comes to these smaller guys. That said, Mo, Jalen Brunson is a great player. And there are, like, really great, you know, high level small guards in the NBA. Most of those guys weren't drafted in the top five, top 10. Maybe they should have been, and they didn't because they were small. So I don't know if this is like, you know, the chicken before the egg or what when it comes to these players, but maybe this is the NBA recalibrating with Kingston Flemings and saying, oh, you can be small and still be a high level player. Maybe that's what this is. But some of those recent picks have are trending towards bust status, or are just not meeting the expectations of a pick at that level. How do you think Flemings does compare, though, to some of the other guards in the draft, whether it's Brown or Sturts or some of these other guys? Where are they at behind him on your board?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think going, even adding on to your point about, you know, where does kind of the NBA look to project forward. And for a guy like Brunson, who is such an exceptional 2-foot scorer in the paint, I think for starters, it's about getting downhill, right? It's being able to accept contact and really get to the rim at a high level, which I feel like for a guy like Flemings, he does that at the highest level of the kind of next guard batch of him, Sturts, Fylde, Mikal Brown. I think when you look at Flemings. He is probably the best driver of the batch, and I think that says a lot. I think I would say a guy like Filon, who really comes kind of to a close second. You know, I think he's really improved this season, but I think for Filon, he's somebody who, you know, I kind of have my guard tier as a Flemings. Right next tier would be LeBaron Filon, and then kind of in this next batch would be Mikael Brown Jr. And I've kind of started to warm off a little bit of Bennett Sturts. I think as we've kind of ventured into conference play, it's really just a matter of what can these guards do when they're met with a lot of physicality. And I think that's something that's been a real struggle for two guys in Mikael Brown and Bennett Sturts, where, you know, they're such exceptional shooters and really high level creators with the ball in their hands. And, you know, what does the game look like when, you know, it's slowed down for the ball's not in their hands? I think for a guy like Mikael's case, it's really just about availability currently with a back injury. And, you know, he's just been really inefficient, but, you know, we know what he looks like when he is hitting, which, you know, you can look at this summer at FIBA play where he was just super high level, getting downhill, getting just his shots. And I think there's a lot of elite level guards in this class, but it all comes with a contingency. And I think with a guy like Flemings, I have the least amount of questions, which to say, you know, comparing the top three to this next batch of guards, it's just a matter of like, what do you nitpick the least with them? And I think with a guy like Flemings, who he's the best defender of that next guard batch, he's the best driver of the best batch in that group. And I think the size projects the best of them all. I think, you know, they are all kind of in that 6'2 to 6'4-ish range. And I'm putting this with air quotes until we kind of get more idea of measurements. But yeah, they're kind of in that next batch from a frame perspective, but it's really just like the atypical skills that Flemings gives me. And I think I just trust in him the most in terms of the defense and also just the frame. Like he has a 6'7 wingspan. And, you know, for me, I think this is something we're even definitely going to have a chance to mention down the stretch of the show, where, you know, guards, I think when you're evaluating guards, it's super important to see, do they really possess like plus level positional size, strength, and just outlier skills. And I think with a guy like Flemings, who he just has a crazy burst. You know, he's somebody that can leverage the size that he has getting downhill. And like I said earlier, getting to his spots with that burst. And I think of this next batch, I think he just offers the best blend or intersection of the physicality, the length, and just the creation skill. And that's not to say that these next batch of guys don't have that, but I think they just have a lot more frame questions or athletic limitations for me to kind of buy in on them more than a guy like Kingston Fleming.
All right, it's time for an NBA rookie check-in. I want to talk about the top four because Cooper Flagg, obviously, number one. Seems like he could be potentially the rookie of the year. Con Knipple, who was fourth, seems to be the lead contender for rookie of the year. And then you have VJ Edgecombe, who's been excellent for the Sixers. And then Dylan Harper, number two for the San Antonio Spurs, got off to an excellent start, downhill attacking. He's not shot the ball very well at all this past month, only 16.7% from three-point range since December 19th. So it's been up and down for Dylan Harper so far this year. With that in mind, Mo, I am curious, if the Spurs got a chance to redo that second pick, do the Spurs still take Dylan Harper over Con Knipple and VJ Edgecombe?
I mean, I think when you think about the Spurs, right, like, how loaded that guard room is, I think this is a good problem to have as a start. You know, I think we really didn't anticipate Stephon Castle to kind of take that leap that he did this season, just as a two-way prospect. And he's really taking that next step. And I think that's kind of put the pressure on Harper to kind of just come in and impact in the minutes that he has. And me personally, I think if they were to do it over again, I still would take Harper. I think when you're at the number two spot, you're going to take the best pick available. And I think Harper, outside of a guy like Flagg, offers the most upside as a lead creator and a true star bet. And I think with a guy like Khan, I think we knew that these skills were present in terms of the off-ball shooting and just what he's able to do with the ball in his hands as just a PR creator, as somebody that can be an elite level spot-up creator. But I didn't think it was going to happen so soon. You know, I think this record that he has of 103 points made as a rookie, I don't think that's going to get beat anytime soon in a long time. I think he's somebody that, it's just super efficient. But I think with a guy like Harper, who, you know, he's had some lingering injuries and, you know, it was a pretty up and down season at Rutgers. I think one thing that was consistent was he is an elite paint creator. And I think those were things that are a pick of the litter with a guy like him. He really projects high level. And I think, again, it's the shooting will come around. You know, he did have really good priors, you know, whether that was in high school, whether that was in college as an off-ball creator. You know, the shooting was, I think, in the 85th or the 86th percentile in points per shots, super as a spot-up shooter. So the potential is there. And that was kind of the thought process coming into the season where, you know, if you did suck a guy like Dylan Harper, how is he going to work alongside a Fox, a Castle, or just be that complement next to a guy like Wembanyama? So I think for me, if I was to do it all over again, I would still take the best pick available, and that is Dylan Harper. I mean, you see, he just is such an elite creator downhill. He's just essentially a free paint touch, and that plus the size and, you know, him being able to just take that leap athletically and as a shooter is kind of just that next level projection for him to be just a star guard bed. So, yeah. But that doesn't really take away from a guy like Colin Kemba.
I mean, I hope it happens. I think with the Spurs prior to the draft, Mo, I was pretty consistent in saying that I would trade down and take a Colin Kemba. Take a VJ Edgecombe. Obviously, Edgecombe wasn't possible because he went three, but Con at four, I still think would have been the best possible outcome for San Antonio. And I feel that way even more strongly at this point. And it's been interesting with Spurs fans this year. I'm like getting a sense, you know, maybe it's just my For You page considering my prior perspective, but, you know, I'm seeing some Spurs fans express like, maybe we should have taken Khan. Like, we could use another knockdown shooter, and he still provides creation as well. And so that's where I come to when it comes to this choice of the Spurs. Dylan Harper very well couldn't end up the best player of their possible choices. But ultimately, boy, can you imagine Khan Knipple out there with De'Aaron Fox and Stephon Castle and Victor Wembanyama and Keldon Johnson and Harrison Barnes? Like, talk about elevating the team today with what they are as a potential contender, but still maintaining elite level upside in the future. This is the one from at Biggie Spurs. This is the one I saw this morning. Adam Silver handed us a free dynasty, and we picked Dylan Harper over VJ Edgecombe and Colin Kemba. That was the one that I saw on social earlier today. And I have kind of seen that from some Spurs fans as of late, like, ooh, well, maybe we should have taken Colin Kemba. But that is not necessarily a knock on Dylan Harper with all the things he does well. It is also a compliment to Edgecombe and Kemba with what they've turned into early in their careers for the Sixers and for the Charlotte Hornets. I am curious, Mo, when it comes to a guy like Edgecombe, right? Very rocky season for him at Baylor. Crappy point guard play impacting him out there. And then he goes to Philadelphia and he's great right away. Is there a prospect in this year's draft class that's in a iffy, ugly situation, less than ideal situation that you're like, he's going to be better right away as an NBA player than he was in college?
I mean, that's tough. There's a lot of guys that are kind of in that boat. I think maybe, for example, one of the guys, it could be like a Darius Acuff, right? I think you're seeing a guy like him be really leaned on in a Cal system where it's him with the keys in his hands to be really effective as pretty much the linchpin for your entire team, right? Being the guy who, you know, pre-NCAA, he was kind of a scoring, handling guard, and, you know, coming to Arkansas now, being that guy that kind of has to set the table for everybody and really kind of tap into the decision-making and also just showing what could he do maybe on the defensive end. And, you know, I think one thing with him, his measurements and just kind of his archetype of guard, you know, being on the shorter end, which is kind of a consistent theme with a lot of guards in this class outside of the top three, is, you know, what can you do and project as from college and high school and hopefully into the league? And I think a guy like Darius Acuff, who maybe doesn't necessarily have the most favorable scenario with, you know, not the best shooting around him, not the best guard play, pretty inconsistent play for guys like Carter Knox or Malik Thomas. He's been kind of that guy that's just been consistent night in and night out, especially in SEC play. And he's been really consistent against high level competition. So I think a guy like Acuff is somebody that probably might project better into the league. I mean, that's a potential shout. I think one of my best bets would be a guy like Hannah Steinbeck from Washington, where, you know, I think that team heading into the season, considering all the transfers that they got and, you know, kind of the hype around a guy like Steinbeck following FIBA play, he was somebody that I was going to say is probably not in the most favorable front court setting. And he's going to be very tasked with pretty much everything offensively for that Washington team. And he's kind of just came in and just blew my expectations out of the water. And this is, again, saying a guy who, you know, at 18, when he was playing in Germany, you know, in my time watching guys like Noah Singe, Ben Seraf when they were playing for Ratio Farm Ohm, in the times that they played a guy like this guy, Hannes Steinbeck, he was kind of the best prospect on the court. Mind you, there was two first round picks in the 2025 draft playing. And it was this 18-year-old guy that was, you know, the best prospect on the court. And that's saying a lot, you know, considering Steinbeck was at one point leading the entire German BBL in player efficiency. So I think for him, there's a lot of things to like with a guy like Steinbeck in terms of the rebounding, the size, the touch, kind of the intersection with skills. So I think guys like Acuff, Steinbeck, who, you know, maybe necessarily aren't in the most favorable scenarios currently compared to previous season expectations, I think they just outshine their expectation. And, you know, in a tweet like this, what he's really doing to open his freshman season is pretty remarkable. You know, for a guy who was leading the FIBA U19 in rebounding, you know, I think that was something that initially I was expecting to translate right away, was just, is he going to be able to come in? And, you know, I was watching an interview and it was something about Jokic talking about, you know, his ability to get triple doubles at a high level. And, you know, one of the sentiments was the ball loves him. And I think that's something that kind of translates to a guy like Hannes Steinbeck, where the ball really does love him. And he's somebody who, you know, is second in the NCAA in rebounding. And, you know, at 6'11", to pair that kind of rebounding skill with the kind of excellent hands and just shooting touch and just overall IQ and basketball feel, he is somebody that is one of the most productive players in the entire nation as a freshman. And he's somebody that is really garnering a lot of, you know, lottery and ultimately for me, top 10 pick range for me. And like I said in my tweet, you know, this intersection is producing one of the most productive big man profiles of the last 15 years and not saying a lot. So yeah, I would say those two guys, Steinbeck and Acuff, are not in the most favorable situations, but are doing a lot more than expected with the hands that they've been dealt with.
Let's move on to our weekly movers. And I want to start us off here with Braylon Mullins over at UConn. He's missed the start of the season, but boy, he's been excellent. Excellent for UConn. Last week against Providence in an overtime win for UConn, he had 24 points, 8 of 14. He hit 6 three-pointers in the game. He's probably the best shooter in the class. You know, maybe Darren Peterson aside, if you want to put him first. But Braylon Mullins, the versatility that he has off the catch, off the dribble as well, the feel for the game at 6'6", to me, Mo, like this, he just looks like a clear cut. This dude's going to be a pro for a long time in the NBA.
Yeah. I mean, with a guy like Mullins, he is somebody where pre-NCAA in the Adidas circuit for 3SSP, he was a remarkable shooter, 40% or 47% from 3-point on 6 3-points a game in Adidas. And, you know, he's somebody where he's one of the best shooters in this class, if not the best, I would say at least top 3 for me. And, you know, when you look at UConn historically, like they love this archetype of guards where, you know, you can kind of come in, shoot the ball at a high level and really connect play. But I think he offers a different element than guys in previous, like Liam McNeely, Alex Caravan, maybe a Jordan Hawkins from previous, where it's the things that he does off the ball in terms of the feel, the defense, and, you know, at the size at 6'7" or 6'6", he really is effective as just a shooter. And I think you can see right away he's coming in, impacting UConn at a high level, which says a lot, you know, for a team that's won back-to-back championships in the last 3 years. You know, he is somebody that has been super important in their success. And I think when you look at a guy like Mullins, he 100% screams longtime NBA vet. And, you know, I was mentioning this with earlier, with a guy like Colin Knuppel, who, you know, that pre-NCAA profile where, you know, they're not necessarily the entire same player, but kind of that bigger size jumbo wing that can shoot the ball at a high level, really create for others and, you know, offer a very like stout profile. I think with a guy like Mullins, he, I think, projects a lot better, you know, in terms of kind of the feel that he has in the defense. And I think, again, he just really projects as a high level defender. And I think even coming into the season with the ankle injury, I was a little skeptical, but, you know, I still had him as a top 20 guy. And I was just really leaning on the pre-NCAA tape, and he's come in and just really blew my expectations out of the water. And I completely agree. This is a longtime vet in the making, and I think the shooting, the feel, the defense is the reason why.
Won't shock me if Mullins ends up in the top 10 come draft night. Who's a guy that you have moving up your board?
Oof. I mean, for me, I think one of the number one names is a guy like Joshua Jefferson from Iowa State. You know, he's been somebody that, you know, coming into the season, I was a little worried with what he's able to do in terms of the shooting, kind of the feel. And I think he's really been playing at an All-American level this season for Iowa State, who is playing undefeated, playing one of the best brands of basketball, one of the best defenses. And it's been really led by a guy like Joshua Jefferson, who, you know, 6'8", hybrid forward, really dribble, pass, shoot. You know, he possesses a really strong archetype. And, you know, coming into the season, as I said, I was really curious to see his growth as a shooter. You know, 31% from in his junior season, 27% from three in his sophomore season. And he's coming out the gate right now, 37% on really good volume. And it's kind of the other things as well that he's grown. You know, he's becoming a high-level playmaker, 27.8% assist rate, and he's doing that on a really good efficiency in terms of his turnovers. So for me, Joshua Jefferson, he's been in the conversation in terms of All-Americans for me and this season. And I think he's somebody that's really shot on my boards. You know, preseason, I was thinking this guy as, you know, if the shooting can improve, kind of just the overall feel, maybe he can kind of creep into maybe mid to early second round for me. But, you know, he's been somebody that, you know, has pretty much entered as like my 19th or 18th rated prospect, and, you know, just the gradual improvements. You know, I think I'm a little weary though with, you know, with guys that have small sample sizes of really good shooting, you know, i.e. maybe a guy like Devin Carter from previous, where, you know, does the shooting stick, you know, when you have a long history of inconsistent perimeter play. But, you know, for a guy like Joshua Jefferson, he's really, really improved a lot this season. And he's been somebody that's been very vocal and very integral in Iowa State success. So yeah, a lot of love with a guy like him. And he's been somebody that's been really moving up for me, especially in conference play, you know, averaging 16 points, 10 rebounds, 6 assists. He's been somebody that's just been super impactful for the Cyclones.
Yeah, he's the type of guy who impacts the game without even just shooting the ball. He's someone who can make a positive impact even if the shot's not falling. And Iowa State has a big game on Tuesday against Kansas. Boy, like, this is going to be a good one. Like, Iowa State's been awesome this year. They have a ton of prospects, not just Jefferson as well, and Kansas, of course. Hopefully we see we get a full dose of Darren Peterson. What are you going to be watching for in this game, Mo?
I think for me, you know, you just kind of gave me the alley-oop with Darren Peterson. It's the people that he's going to be matching up against defensively with Killian Torrey and Tame and Limsey, arguably the best defensive backcourt in the nation. And, you know, it's, like I said, they've been very important in Iowa State's success just as a team defensively. And, you know, with a guy like TJ Otzelberger as the coach, he's really spoke very vocal about this backcourt and, you know, how they've given a lot of high-level guards problems, you know, i.e. Bennett Sturts, who, you know, I think that's one of the games that, you know, I think he would really love to take back, and just the ways that they guard him, you know, and they're just really hounding guys 94 feet. And I think this is a game for me to watch very closely, just that guard matchup between Darren Peterson versus Killian Torrey and Tina Limsey. And like I said, I think this Iowa State team, I think they're just flurried with a lot of NBA prospects. I think you were mentioning earlier about just the shooting, and for a guy like, you know, Milan Momcilovic, I think he's personally my favorite shooter in this class, a guy that's 6'8", and just, he's just so high-level shooter. He's just a sniper, and I think when you get a chance to watch him, it's just, he's just shooting a ball and just a pool at this point. And I think with him, you know, up to plus 50% and three-point this season, career 48% three-point shooter, he is just a remarkable shooter. And like I said, I think this is going to be a really important game for Kansas, who, you know, I think they've gotten to learn a lot of what the season's like without Darren Peterson. So it's kind of the other guy stepping up, i.e. Melvin Council and Trey White. You know, I think a guy also that may be pretty much closely watching as a guy like Flory Badungu, who, you know, he had a really hot start to the season, and I think kind of opening up the game in terms of just the feel and the playmaking and already the high level like rim protection and athleticism that he brings. I'm really curious to see how he kind of handles this Iowa State front court, who's been giving a lot of teams problems when met with size. So yeah, this is going to be a really, really good game. And I don't know, Kansas, it's just a matter of if Darren Peterson plays and if he can kind of see the game throughout in the second half. You know, if he can play, I mean, we know what he can do. He's one of the best guard prospects, you know, we've ever evaluated. And I think the scoring is not a joke. You know, being able to kind of put up 20 points at ease in a first half, it's really just, is he able to kind of sustain that play in the second half? And yeah, just a remarkable two-way talent. I mean, there's no surprise why Darren Peterson is my number one prospect, and it's been the case for some time now. He's just a high level shooter, high level scorer. And I think one thing that really just gets overlooked is the defense. And it's tough with, you know, the hamstring injury. It's been very lingering in terms of his ability to impact the way that, you know, we really know truly what Darren Peterson could be, but truly a all NBA caliber defender. And, you know, with a guy like Darren Peterson, I truly believe he's going to be the, at least in my eyes, the first prospect picked off the board. Hopefully if he can sustain himself, and you know, it might be crazy to say, but, you know, I think at full health, I think he sits at a tier of his own at the 1-1, wow. Which is crazy. It's crazy, wow, to say, because I know, again, you know, you look at the batch that he's playing with, you see AJ DeBanza, you see Cameron Boozer. Cameron Boozer's playing like the best player in the nation. AJ DeBanza's looking like the most improved of the batch of those three guys. But I think Darren Peterson has the most to offer of the three, with probably the least amount of holes compared to the other two guys. But I think at full health, he is somebody that can just carry a team on both ends of the floor. And I mean, you're seeing this Kansas team, which, you know, for a team that coming into the season had a lot of questions if, you know, what would everybody else look like around Darren? I mean, I think you're seeing what he is for that team. He's everything. You know, a lot of the backlash that he's been getting, which, you know, again, this hamstring injury is no joke, but, you know, in full health, I don't think anybody can mess with him. So at least that's my hot take for the day.
No, I mean, the tier one on his own. I mean, you're probably not alone in saying that, but you're definitely one of the few going that far, especially given the up and down year he's had compared to Cam Boozer and AJ DiBonsa. But it does show how strong you're feeling about him. And who knows? Maybe we'll see him get healthy by the end of the year and prove that and show that he's the clear-cut number one. And against Iowa State, that's certainly one of the opportunities for him to do that against their excellent defense. And so, Mo, thank you so much for joining me, man. I really enjoy your stuff. I think you're one of the best follows covering the draft at MCF NBA. Why'd you get started doing this? What's your background?
Yeah, so, I mean, for me, I've been super passionate about just the NBA, but I think the draft in particular, you know, I've always been kind of a kid growing up watching the NBA draft and, you know, just having my little iPod or iPhone ready, just watching, like, who are they going to announce as this pick, and having genuine excitement between, you know, who is actually selected, getting a chance to see. Because I was somebody that was always a college guy growing up, so being able to kind of say, you know, following that and actually seeing that be something that's, you know, a career, and, you know, being able to go back to school, do my master's in data science and really learn about the world of numbers and kind of seeing how that's been really important in the game of basketball. And you're seeing that now. I think, you know, the men lie, women lie, the numbers don't. And I think we've been able to kind of see in the NBA and just in sports in general, the impact of data and what the analytics tells us and how you can kind of use that to just play at a different game and use that edge. So, you know, being able to just kind of look at the NBA draft and just overall scouting from a different lens and offer something different than maybe what the space has, and, you know, combining film and tape as well as the numbers and seeing what kind of gems, what kind of high level numbers and just information that we can get. So yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate this opportunity. The pleasure is mine, and yeah, super excited to connect and look forward to doing more work. So thank you so much.
Thank you, man. I mean, keep up the awesome work. Like I said, one of the best follows covering the draft. I mean, every single day you're posting something insightful. So keep up the great work, Mo, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. I hope you have a blessed rest of your day and all the best with your work. And yeah, looking forward to connecting soon. So thank you.
Big thank you again to Andrew Sharp and Mo for joining me on today's episode. Thanks to the whole production team for putting the show together. Thanks to you for giving us a listen, and to Father John Misty for the music. We'll be back again on Thursday. Tom Haberstroh. Looking forward to that. Have a good week, everybody.